The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today. And we are delighted to be joined now by Professor Victor Davis Hanson. Professor, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So have you had a chance to see any of the House impeachment hearing today?
Yeah, I saw some of it, and I was working in the yard, and I just listened to it on my earphones. So I saw a lot of it.
What was your impression?
It was more or less a waste of time, to be frank. I mean, the Democrats brought in three left-wing academics, and they had no new evidence. They had nothing other to say that to find a way to give constitutional justification for impeaching Trump. And at least the Republicans got a guy that voted against Trump, Turley. He's pretty good. I thought he was much more impressive, but it would have strengthened the Democratic case if at least one of those people had voted for Trump and then was arguing that he should be impeached. But they were all pretty partisan. There was no new argument. One of my colleagues at Stanford, I didn't think was very impressive at all. But it was really low blow to start descending into making fun of the president's teenage son.
Let's pause on that. Let's pause on that, Professor, because Hugh Hewitt, I've been following. I haven't seen any of the hearing myself, but I followed it on Twitter as I've been on the radio here. And Hugh Hewitt is referring to this as the Carlin catastrophe. not only because of the her barren Trump joke, which she's now apologized for, by the way. The blowback was obviously intense. She's already apologized for that. But also, I mean, she's a nut, a hater. In her testimony, and this is the kind of a thing that she wouldn't have had to say this. Nobody could have dragged it out of her, you know. But she testified that one time she was walking along and she was going to go by a Trump hotel, and she crossed the street so that she wouldn't have to walk in front of the Trump hotel. And the Democrats put this woman on as unbiased expert witness.
I know. I don't know what they did. Anybody who knows of her campus career knows that she's a hardcore partisan. She's an Obama and Clinton donor. At one time, Obama thought about appointing her to the Supreme Court, but she was deemed too far left for Obama. And Elena Kagan was considered centrist in comparison. But she, it wasn't very good. And I debated Noah Feldman before, and during the Iraq War, and at Columbia, I think it was, it was at Columbia University. I didn't find him a very impressive character. I didn't today again. So I didn't think there were any stellar witnesses on their part. I think the Republicans were better cross-examiners. They're getting used to that role now a lot better than being prosecutors, the Democrats being prosecutors. So I just don't think this had anything to do with finding Trump guilty or not guilty of anything. It's just a way of trying to find the necessary academics to say that what we're doing, we know what we're doing is wrong, but we're going to wheel somebody out and say that it's not historically inappropriate or something. And I don't think they even fulfilled that agenda very well.
I may be wrong about this, Professor, but I've got a feeling that the story that's going to come out of these hearings, out of today's hearing, that people are actually going to hear about, because the percentage of people who actually tune in and sit and watch this is infinitesimal, right? And so it's all a kind of post-hearing spin that they see in newspaper headlines, snippets on the evening news, that kind of thing. I've got a feeling that the main takeaway from today's hearing is going to be what Hugh called the Carlin catastrophe, you know, the hate-filled testimony capped off with a bizarre and inappropriate reference to Barron Trump, for which she's now apologized. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. And there's going to be a lot of bad sound bites because they asked Professor Feldman had he ever thought about impeachment. It was pretty clear that he was talking about impeaching Trump within 2 weeks of his election. And so that didn't come off well either. And I think it's the same thing that's happened in the House Intelligence Committee hearings, that you get in this bubble in Washington and you go out and think, wow, our people are very impressive, but they have no idea how the average person listens to a diplomat with that bow tie and reciting all of his generations of experience and his family and his pedigree and his ancestry, or that an academic with sort of a whiny nasal accent pontificating, that doesn't go over well. And just to give you an example, I was watching this, and a farmer that's in my neighborhood, he very calls me, call up, and he was just irate. He came in for lunch and saw part of it. He said, what the hell is going on here? And then I just went down to a local cafe, and I'm here in the Central Valley, and two people came up to me and said, have you seen this? And that's not scientific, but I think it's not going to go over well, the social, economic, cultural aspects of the hearing. They don't favor the Democrats. It looks too vindictive. It looks too mean-spirited. It looks too arrogant. It's the argument of by authority, not by logic or analysis. You should believe this person we've wheeled out because she's a Stanford law professor, or this person teaches at Harvard, or this person is a third-generation diplomat. Americans, they don't like that. They never have.
No, I think you're right about that. And this whole idea of kicking off the process, you know, the first hearing, the first day of hearings should be a big day. You know, I mean, I used to be a trial lawyer, as you know, for 41 years. And if you're putting on a case for a plaintiff, you want to start with a bang. You know, you don't start with some, you know, four boring witnesses. You want to get to the point. You want to get to the facts that show why you got to win this case.
I was worried because I don't think Trump deserved to be impeached, and I was worried that they were going to get John Bolton, wheel him out, and all of a sudden John Bolton is going to be there, and John Bolton will be miffed that he was let go unceremoniously, and he's going to say, Donald Trump looked at me in the eye and said the following. Had that happened, it could happen in the future. I think that would be pretty injurious to the president's case, but this was not, there was nothing new, and it was just more academic, diplomatic regurgitation, and they can't get away from the central truth that Donald Trump may have thought about A or B, but in reality, the aid went through after a brief delay. There was nobody fired. There was no coercion. There was a meeting with the Ukrainians. So he's guilty at best of a thought crime, and they couldn't get away from that. They kept giving these strange metaphors and similes about, you know, speeding and burglary, but they never were apt. And when you juxtapose that to the reality that as Obama's personal emissary on Ukraine, Joe Biden actually did get a prosecutor fired. And more importantly, he threatened not just lethal aid, which they were not willing to give Ukraine. He was going to cut off, you know, humanitarian, every type of aid.
$1 billion
if he didn't get his way. Yeah, and that won't go away. And then a couple of really good Republican inquisitors said, wait a minute, what is the standard? And they mentioned all these quid pro quos of past presidents. I mean, Barack Obama did get missile defense in cooperation with Eastern Europeans canceled. He canceled it. And he's on a mic saying that he was willing to be flexible about that issue that the Russians wanted canceled if Putin would behave during the 2011-12 campaign cycle. And guess what? Putin did. And then as soon as Obama was reelected, he invaded Crimea a year later, and then he invaded eastern Ukraine. Now, I don't think Obama should have been impeached for that, but the standard is a president trying to use foreign policy to benefit his own political career, then Obama's guilty of it. And that's the problem, is that there's no equality under the law, and Americans keep saying, well, wait a minute. Obama did this, and Clinton did this, and Bush did this. And they weren't impeached. Clinton was, but not like this. It was a very lengthy process.
Right. And maybe I'm an outlier here. And maybe I'm an outlier here, Professor, but I think I speak for a lot of Americans. Worst case, the worst thing you can say about Trump is that he at least pondered the idea of using this lethal aid to try to induce the government of Ukraine to investigate the payment of $3 million to the Biden family by Burisma, right? That's the worst thing you can say, that he considered doing it but didn't actually do it. What I think is that Ukraine should have investigated that. I hope they still investigate. I think if the president says to Ukraine, you really should investigate that $3 million payment because it seems obviously to be a bribe, and it's a transnational bribe, Ukrainian company, American politician, that should be investigated. And I think the more that people talk about these events, the harder it's going to be for the Democrats to explain to voters why Joe Biden is above the law. Why can't he be?
No, you're absolutely right, because they're making the argument that Trump will benefit by hurting Biden in the 2020 election. But first of all, Biden's not even the nominee yet, and Trump is not the nominee yet. So we don't know who is going to be the actual two candidates. And just because Biden may be running for president at this moment doesn't give him legal exemption from his behavior while he was vice president. And then the other strange thing is we're going to have senators, Biden, maybe Booker, Klobuchar, and they're going to be what?
Say, Victor, we're coming up against a hard break. Can we hold you for another segment?
Yeah.
Terrific. We will be right back after these messages. Here we go. Look at that volume down a little bit there, Professor Hanson. Before the break, we were talking about the fact that there just isn't a factual predicate here that makes any sense as an impeachment case. On the worst case scenario, in my view, President Trump didn't do anything wrong.
I don't think he did either. I think that Biden seems to think, or the Democrats seem to think, that because he's a candidate, he's not the nominee, but he just declared that he's a candidate, then he gets an exemption from any past legal exposure. And what's even stranger is that they apparently are going to have Senators Sanders, Warren, Booker, who are running for president. If this thing drags on, then they're going to sit in judgment over somebody they think is going to be their likely presidential opponent. So the whole thing is fraught with all sorts of inconsistencies. I think the problem, John, is that in the Clinton and Nixon impeachment, we had a special prosecutor's report, Leon Jaworski's grand jury synopsis, and we had the Ken Starr report. And we've had one, and the problem is they don't have another one. And the one that we do have is exonerating, at least on collusion and non-actionable obstruction. And then those were second-term presidents. We haven't done this before in the modern era, right before an election. So it has the whiff that you're trying to preclude an election, and it's a partisan against a first-term president. And what sunk Nixon wasn't necessarily that his popularity died because of Watergate. It died because the economy went into recession in November of 73, and the oil embargo and et cetera. And so people in his own party started to flee from him. And so but in Clinton's case, he pretty much, Ken Starr said that he was guilty of perjury and obstruction. And yet the Democrats wisely stuck with him because they had a booming economy, and his popularity stayed pretty good. And Trump's got a good economy. So it's just not a good idea, I think, to impeach a first-term president right before an election because you disagree with his policies. And just as we saw with the end of the filibuster, there'll be consequences. And there'll come a day not too long from now, and we'll have a really controversial, obnoxious Democratic president, and people are going to say, you know what, let's impeach the SOB just like they did. And that's a bad precedent.
It's a terrible precedent. And one of the things, to your point, one of the things that came out in today's hearing is that, I think I'm saying this correctly, 17 Democratic members of this committee, the House Judiciary Committee, had already come out for impeaching President Trump back in 2017. I mean, this isn't about Ukraine. This isn't about the July 2019 phone call with Zelensky. They've been itching to impeach Trump ever since he got inaugurated.
No, they have. And that was pointed out again during the hearing. And they did it again in July of this year. They were on record they wanted to impeach him. And I just don't think they, by any Nixon or Clinton standard, they're not following any prior precedent that we know of in the modern era. That's closer, as I think Turley pointed out, to the Andrew Johnson frame up, which was a black mark in American history. But I think they're going to go ahead and do it because I don't think Nancy Pelosi can stop them. And I hope that these 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 even, because I have a congressman in a plus 8 district where I live, and he's already in the polls about 12 points over a former congressman that was kicked out by one of these new so-called centrist Democrats. And he's going to run and have a rematch, and he's already way ahead in the polls because people are getting angry about this. And I think that it's going to be catastrophic in the way that it was to the Republicans. They took a beating. They lost seats in the 98. They even lost seats in the 2000 election in the House. People were so angry. And I was a person that thought there were legal grounds for impeaching Clinton. But this case was not even close to Clinton's wrongdoing.
No, I think you're right. Let me bounce a thought off you and see if you agree with it. One thing that's going on here, I think, is that the $3 million that were paid to the Biden family by Burisma, and then we know from an email thread that they used Hunter Biden's name being on their board to almost immediately get an appointment with a high-level person in the State Department to plead their case on these corruption issues. And of course, Hunter Biden doesn't even speak Ukrainian. You know, he knows nothing about natural gas. I mean, he's kind of a ne'er-do-well. The idea that there's any reason to pay him $3 million other than you're buying influence with the guy who's in charge of Ukraine policy for the Obama administration is fanciful. And isn't this a classic example of the swamp? We've seen this over and over and over again, whether it's Tom Daschle or Harry Reid or, you know, all kinds of people. They spend their whole life in so-called public service, you know, earning modest salaries in the Senate or the House or whatever. And then they retire, and lo and behold, they're rich. You know, they're rich. Well, how did that happen? And
you're absolutely right. I don't know how the Clintons ended up with a net worth of $100 million without ever having a job in the private sector.
Right.
But it was always predicated on the idea that they were going to be president. One of the two would be president, and they kept leveraging. Now that that's over with, notice that the foundation and their bank accounts are hurting because nobody wants to give them anything or hire them to do anything because they have no leverage. Yeah, I think that's one of the more depressing things about the whole matter. And when Vindman came up and we were supposed to be so impressed with him, and he basically said that his own twin brother was the ethics counselor in the NSC that he talked to for advice. And then he talked to the whistleblower, apparently, although he said he didn't know who the whistleblower was, but he couldn't answer because he might expose him. And then he tells us that Ukraine was offering him the Ministry of Defense, and this is a lieutenant colonel. So you get the impression that I'm not so impressed with these Ukrainians. I think that they were trying to bribe, leverage anybody they could at any time, and it was sober and judicious for Trump just to say, you know what, I don't like giving foreign aid to that part of the world anyway. And these guys have been trying to, in general, corrupt people in the United States, and in particular me, and I'm sick and tired of them. I'm just going to take a deep breath and look at this. And I think that was wise for him to do that. And I don't think they're going to – I think most Americans can't see anything wrong with doing that, and it's going to boomerang. I don't know – the only success I think the Democrats are having is that we've been in this now 4 weeks, and Trump should be back up in the Real Clear Politics average polls to 46, 47, where he was getting close to, and he's down to about 43. So I think it bleeds his popularity a little bit. But
I think it does, too. I think the whole purpose, they know he's not going to be convicted in the Senate, but the whole purpose is to get thousands of newspaper headlines that combine the word Trump and the word impeachment, right, just to try to drag him down.
Absolutely. I agree. It's all about him, and it has some degree of success so far. They think the American people want to go into a fetal position and just say, make it all go away, get rid of Trump. I'm tired of it. I can't
take
it anymore.
I'm tired of hearing about Trump. Victor Davis Hanson, exactly. Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. We got to run to a break, and we'll come back with your calls at 602-508-0960. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline, filling in for Seth today. I'm going to be off tomorrow and back on Friday. And I think before too long, Seth is going to be returning from the Holy Land, where he is with Dennis Prager and others. So if you want to talk about any of the things we've been discussing, and lately it's primarily been the impeachment hearing going on in Washington, D.C. that ended just a little while ago, give us a call. I'd be happy to take calls for the rest of the hour at 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Otherwise, I'm going to change the subject completely and talk about something different. Get far away from Washington, D.C., far away from the Democrats and their impeachment charade and a lot of the nonsense that we see in the news. Now, this is about nonsense. It's just different nonsense. But it's relevant in part because of the fact that Seth is currently in Israel. And so I want to talk about something that I wrote about on Powerline a day or two ago. And the title of my post was Fantasists of the Palestinian Authority. And what it deals with is the fact that leaders of the Palestinians, whether it's in the PA or in Gaza, have this theory that the Palestinians are descended from the Canaanites, who are referred to in the Bible and some other ancient sources, who were living in the land of Canaan when the Israelites arrived there long, long ago. And there's this theory, which is completely baseless, that today's Palestinians, who are just Arabs, you know, like others in the area, the Arabs invaded that area, the Levant, in the 7th century. But the theory is that, no, the Palestinians are descended from the ancient Canaanites, and therefore they have been in that part of the world for a long, long time. And conversely, and this is where it really gets insane, the theory that these people propagate is that there were never any Jews in what is now Israel. There were never any Jews in the Holy Land. There were never any Jews in Judea, Samaria, Galilee, until very, very recently, like starting in 1948. That's the first time any Jewish people ever came to that region. And that theory is so insane that you wonder how anybody could try to assert it with a straight face. And yet the culture in that part of the world is so strange and so faulty that they do. They actually try this. So this is from Palestinian Media Watch. I'm going to read here this report, a portion of it. Palestinian Media Watch has recorded three examples of Palestinian academics appearing on official PA TV in October and November to discuss the archaeological evidence linking Jews to the region. In all three cases, the academics outright denied that there was any evidence at all of Jewish life in Israel before 1948. Painting the current Jewish population as occupiers and usurpers. Quote, the Jews claim that they were in Palestine 2,000 years ago, Riyad al-Ili, a Palestinian political science lecturer from Al-Azhar University, stated on a program called The Supreme Authority on November 6. He continued, if we look at the history, we will see that they were not in Palestine in the past, but rather only as invaders less than 70 years ago. For these 70 years, they have been invaders like the Hyksos, the Byzantines, the Persians, and British colonialism. The Canaanite Palestinian people have since succeeded in defeating these invaders and continue to live in this land. So that's one instance. Here's another one. Oh, we are coming up against a break, so I'm going to hold that next instance until we return. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about what I think is one of the world's strange phenomena. And it kind of ties in with the fact that Seth is right now over in Israel. And it has to do with the fact that the authorities among the Palestinians seriously tried to promulgate the view that there never were Jews in what's now Israel or that part of the world, Judea, Samaria, Galilee, anywhere, until 1948. Until then, no Jews. They just were invaders or something. And conversely, they propagate the idea that the Palestinians are descended from the Canaanites, who, per the Bible and other sources, were in that land, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. And that, they think, gives them some kind of, you know, prior claim to the land. And you might think this is just an insane fantasy that maybe some ignorant person might believe, but it's hard to imagine that the Palestinian authorities actually try to promote this theory. But it's a fact. It's true. And before the break, I was quoting from this Palestinian political scientist from Al-Azhar University on official Palestinian Authority television on November 6, saying that the Jews were never here. They claimed they were in Palestine 2,000 years ago, but no, they only came as invaders less than 70 years ago. That would be 1948. And here's another one. On November 15, Palestinian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates, Riyad Al-Malki, claimed during a UNESCO session that Palestinian culture was 10,000 years old. He says, Palestine is the cradle of culture and religions, and part of our Palestinian people's past, heritage, and history is engraved on the walls of its capital, Jerusalem. This heritage that Israel, the occupying power, is working to destroy and control, and it is working to falsify the history that is witness to our people's rootedness in its land for more than 10,000 years, which refutes the Israeli occupation's settlement colonialism narrative. And when I hear this said by, you know, high-ranking Palestinian officials and academics, this particular one was a presentation to UNESCO, you know, the United Nations, what is it, Educational, Social, Cultural Organization or something. I mean, I can only wonder, you know, how nonsense like that is received by those people. And my first reaction when I hear this is, have you not read the Bible? You know, I mean, the Bible, you know, documents the long, long history of the Jewish people in the Promised Land. And this is quite a well-known book, widely read. You know, it's been made into movies and television shows. I don't know. Apparently, they haven't read the Bible. But it's not only the Bible. Although, by the way, sticking with that for the moment, you know, Muslims describe themselves conventionally as an Abrahamic religion. You know, they will tell you that they are one of the monotheistic faiths that are descended from Abraham. And okay, so where did Abraham go? You know, Abraham went at God's direction at a rather advanced age to what is now Israel. That was the idea. And we're constantly told that in Islam, Jesus is highly respected as a prophet. So this Jesus, you know, who is a prophet, respected in Islam, where do we learn about him? You know, and where did he live? England, France, Spain, Norway? I don't know. I don't know. So it's very hard to understand how anybody with a straight face can make these kinds of crazy claims. But, you know, it's not only the Bible. You know, if you read Roman historians, there's all kinds of information about the Jews and about Palestine and about Judea. You know, Pontius Pilate, I believe, was the governor of Judea, if I remember correctly. And King Herod, you know, this stuff is all related in, you know, by the Roman historians. And there's simply no doubt about, you know, they had a lot of issues. You know, the Romans, of course, were polytheists, and most people in the Mediterranean world were polytheists. And the Romans were relatively tolerant. If they conquered a new area and those people worshipped certain gods, the Romans were inclined to think that those gods might actually have power in that area, so they'd add them. They didn't care. They'd add them to the list. But the Jews were a problem. They were the only people who were monotheists. And the reason it was a problem is that they wouldn't acknowledge the emperor as a god. They wouldn't worship the emperor. And this led to long, long standing conflicts between the Romans and the Jews. And Roman history is full of this. You read the Roman historians and you learn all about the Jewish people who, to some extent, of course, were living in various places around the Mediterranean, but whose homeland was what is now Israel. And, of course, ultimately, the Romans sent a big army there during the reign of the Emperor Titus, and that's when they destroyed the temple and they murdered tens of thousands of Jews. It was a horrible, horrible catastrophe. And today, if you go to Rome, And you go to the Forum, which is one of the main, you know, tourist areas in Rome, where all these ancient buildings and ruins and so on have been excavated. It's unbelievably interesting, unbelievably impressive. Well, one of the major structures that you see at the Roman Forum is Titus's Arch. And Titus's arch was erected. It's high. I don't know how high, but I mean, it's this huge structure. And it was erected to celebrate the great victory over the Jews and the destruction of the temple and the burning of Jerusalem and so forth. And there's this whole relief, you know, that's carved into this gigantic arch. And one of the most prominent features of this relief is it shows these Roman soldiers carrying the spoils of their victory over the Jews, carrying them away and prominently displayed as this big menorah, right? So you go to Rome and you go to the Forum and you look at Titus's arch and you look up and you're seeing this big menorah. You know, they're celebrating the fact that the Romans have devastated the Jews and carried away their valuables out of the temple. And so, you know, the idea that there's somehow some doubt about this and that any sane person could believe that on the one hand, the Arabs, who didn't arrive until the 7th century, are really the Canaanites, and on the other hand, there were no Jews in Israel until 1948, is so completely ahistorical and so obviously false that one wonders, what's the point? Why would anybody even dream of trying to peddle such absurd claims? I'm going to try to answer that question when we come back from this break. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm John Hinderacher from Powerline. This is our last brief segment of the show. Thank you all for listening, and thank you for the last 3 days for tuning in. I hope I haven't disappointed you too badly here as a guest host. It's been a lot of fun, and there's been a lot in the news, a lot to talk about. So thanks for being with us. I'm going to be off tomorrow, but I will be back guest hosting this show on Friday. So I hope you will tune in then. So before the break, I was talking about this just very weird phenomenon where Palestinian rulers, authorities, academics, politicians seriously try to claim that they are descended from the Canaanites who were in the Holy Land, what's now the Holy Land, 10,000 years ago or whatever, whereas the Jews never lived there. There were no Jews there 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. No, the first Jews arrived in 1948 as invaders. And the point of that is to say that we Palestinians have got a far better prior claim to the land. And that chronology is so bizarre, so obviously false. We know that from the Bible. We know it from Roman historians and all kinds of ancient sources. We know it, of course, from archaeology. I mean, it's just insane. And so you ask yourself, why? why would they, with a straight face, going around telling these obvious lies? And I don't think I can fully answer that question, but I would say this. I think it is symptomatic of a deep sickness in that culture. You know, when we think about reality, we conventionally believe that there is a reality out there that is objective, that is real, that's true. It's not always easy to understand, but it's there and it's real. And when we talk about things, we have an obligation to try to make the things we say correspond to that external objective reality. And if we inadvertently fail to do that, it's a mistake, and we try to correct it. If we on purpose say things that contradict that real world that's out there, well, that's a lie, and that's not just a mistake, that's highly blameworthy. But it seems to me that what we're dealing with here is a culture, as it has developed among a lot of Palestinians, including those who govern the Palestinian territories in Gaza, that they don't accept that. They don't accept the idea that there is an objective reality and that they have to deal with it. They can't just lie about it. They have to deal with it, at least try to. And the question I have is, that being the case, and I think it is the case, you know, how can the people who govern Israel be expected to deal with these leaders in good faith and expect that those leaders are going to show good faith in return? How can they try to make agreements with people who refuse to tell the truth, to face reality about matters that are so clear and so obvious? I just think we can't expect them to do that. Well, that's going to do it for today's show. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back on Friday.